session number 11316, reel 1.
So John Figgis, reel 2.
This perhaps is something that is has not been publicized and perhaps shouldn't be. But at that stage, the American signal intelligence organizations were not yet in business, and I believe that the Royal Naval Signal Intelligence, which had been working for several years, was the only organization actually producing intelligence on the Japanese naval movements. And they had moved from Singapore, temporarily perhaps started to set up in Ceylon, but moved immediately back and then re-established themselves at Mombasa. And there I joined them, and as they were thin on the ground and short of Japanese linguists, I was able to join and lend a hand there. So that although my title was liaison officer to between the Commander-in-Chief India and the Commander-in-Chief Eastern Fleet, I was in fact working with the Royal Naval Signal Intelligence Unit.
Can you give any specific examples of the kind of work that you would do there?
Well, I joined in the production of intelligence, and whenever items appeared in the signals which we intercepted, and certain kinds of codes we could read. The main codes, of course, could only be read intermittently, and usually with delay, but certain kinds of codes were simple codes and were read quickly, and then they contained information of army intelligence, particularly regarding Japanese units, shipping, the kind of units in the southwest which were then deployed throughout the southwest Pacific, which were concerned with army shipment, transshipment, that sort. They were called Akatsuki Butai in Japanese, Akatsuki Butai, and that was the code name. And I kept a very close eye on those and passed the information back to Delhi as I got it. And I had it was a very interesting time for me being with the Royal Navy for about a year and a bit, year and 2 months perhaps. And then in June 43, I should say it was June or July 43, I was summoned back to Delhi to the WEC, that's the Wireless Experimental Center, which was located in a place, a rather ghastly place called Ramjas College, about 7 miles outside Delhi, in a pretty desert-like place, where the signal intelligence setup was now working fully, and where they needed someone to act as the intelligence coordinator, so that I was not involved in any way in the cipher breaking or the in the code breaking or in the network analysis, but I received the raw intelligence, and I had an organization, I had a unit there which dealt with this raw intelligence and collated it and produced as a result intelligence which could be served up to the operational branches of the army in Burma, but of course through headquarters India. And I maintained relations with the headquarters in Delhi, but also later with the Royal Navy, who moved back to Ceylon, to Colombo, and re-established themselves. The people, in other words, that I'd been working with in Mombasa, moved back to Ceylon and re-established themselves there in what was the name of the place? I remember it afterwards. Anyway, there they were. And so I communicated with them and also with the headquarters in India and also with the 14th Army and passed them the intelligence that we, after we'd collated it and passed it to them. Well, that continued until in 1945 I celebrated VE Day. I was in Delhi, and shortly after that I was asked to go to Kandy. Oh, I should have said before that I had an interruption in my job in Delhi for a few weeks in 1944 when Major General Lamplough, Royal Marines, who was Director of Intelligence and in the headquarters of Saxe, that was Lord Louis Mountbatten, was going to Europe to see what lessons might be learned from the events following on the landings in Normandy and the advance into Europe, to see what how the intelligence was being used and how it was being produced and used. In other words, there was a feeling that the production of intelligence and the use of it in Europe was very much better than we had in the Far East, which is quite true, but I think that was partly because the Enigma intelligence was much better than we had. Ours was constantly interrupted, and there were times when we couldn't read the ciphers and could only read them later. This changed afterwards when the Japanese units and formations got cut off in the Southwest Pacific and had to go on using their old code books. Then we could read much more, but for a time we really weren't able to read current material except low-level stuff. So anyway, I was General Lamplough very kindly sent for me to Kandy, and I went with him to Europe. One of his jobs being to examine this question of the use, the production and use of intelligence, and see what lessons could be learned for application to our particular problem. We had a very interesting time, and I remember going up, and it was just at the time of when we arrived, and Eindhoven was just when the Arnhem operation had failed, and the Second Army was halted outside Eindhoven, and we couldn't break through. So it was for me a very interesting, extraordinarily interesting interlude to be there for just a few days and see how things were operating. And of course, there was no question that their intelligence was far superior to anything we were getting from every source, and the way in which they could make use of it was much better. But there were a lot of reasons for that. First of all, there was the SIGINT. Well, the Enigma was very much more current. Above all, they were getting prisoners, and of course our problem was we didn't get prisoners. The only sort of prisoners we got were the lame and the halt and the blind and a few wretches like that. But the Japanese never surrendered. They never, worthwhile, the fighting troops didn't surrender. So we, in India and Burma, we really were suffering very much from intelligence of all kinds, especially from the interrogation of prisoners. The kind of prisoners we got were hardly worth bothering with, for the most part. There may be exceptions, but not much. So then I went back and resumed my job. And in 1945, in July, we knew from our own intercepts that the Japanese were eager to give up and were trying very hard to use the USSR as an intermediary to negotiate terms whereby they could surrender without giving up what they wanted to. I should say that at this stage the American effort was so much greater than ours that our own effort, I think, was completely overwhelmed and outclassed by the American, the enormous resources which the Americans could devote to the to gaining intelligence on the Japanese, but particularly signal intelligence. Their resources were so enormous that they rarely, that our effort was redundant by this stage, and it was apparent to me that we couldn't possibly match it. They were ahead of us, they were in every way. So I think sad though it is to record it, I think that for the last few months of the war, since the Americans were sharing all the intelligence with us, what we were doing wouldn't have mattered.
Do you remember any of the details about these Japanese attempts in July 1945 to come to an agreement with the West?
Well, I don't myself, but it's all well recorded in all in the records. I only know that that was so. I can't remember precisely, but it's all clearly recorded in the Public Record Office or in some documentation, and it's not something that I would personally have a say in. So anyway, August the 15th, the Emperor made his recording and the Japanese laid down their arms. I was then sent for to Kandy, and the then BGSI asked me whether I would be ready to go to Japan.
BGSI?
Brigadier General Staff I, whose name I just forget. He was a brigadier or something. And the situation was that because, and of course now I'm speaking, it's rather hearsay, London had had great difficulty getting information about what was going on in the Southwest Pacific. And they pressed Washington and pressed Washington, but Washington, I understand, said, well, we're sorry, we're no much better off than you because General MacArthur doesn't tell us anything. So then it was agreed that Mr. Churchill should appoint a personal liaison officer with General MacArthur. And with some difficulty, that was agreed. I don't think General MacArthur was frightfully enthusiastic, but perhaps because of Mr. Churchill's great prestige, it was accepted that he would have a personal representative of from Winston Churchill to shortcut all the procedure of going through Washington. And a cavalry officer called General Herbert Lumsden was appointed. I can't say exactly when, but you could easily find out. It must have been fairly early on, I would suppose, in 1945. But General Herbert Lumsden was killed on the bridge of a United States aircraft carrier by a kamikaze attack. And in his place was appointed General Charles Gairdner, G-A-I-R-D-N-E-R, another cavalry officer, who was available. And he was a charming man. He'd been badly wounded in the First World War and had a gammy leg, but he was a great athlete, even with his gammy leg. And I was asked, or at least invited by the BGSI to join General Charles Gairdner as his intelligence officer and go with him to join General MacArthur. So we left Ceylon in early September and went to Manila, where General Gardner already had been established. And from there, and we stayed 2 or 3 days in Manila, and then went on to Japan. So I arrived in Japan about, I think about the 20th of September. Might have been earlier. Middle of September. Roughly. And we went and took up our headquarters in the British Embassy. And we were joined by a Royal Air Force officer, Wing Commander Horder, who was the son of the famous Dr. Horder, the Queen's physician, and by a Brigadier who only stayed a short time and was afterwards replaced by, of all people, Brigadier John Profumo. So that was our team there. And having settled in Japan at that stage, my duty was to liaise on a very regular basis with the headquarters of the Supreme Allied Commander, General MacArthur, and his staff. And of course I was on regular day-to-day, well, constant relations with the headquarters staff at SCAP, with the intelligence staff in particular.
Into how much close contact did you come with General MacArthur?
Well, with General MacArthur himself, I only saw him occasionally, perhaps once or twice. Once or twice a month I actually had to go to his office with General Willoughby. But General Gardner had regular meetings with him. General Gardner had regular meetings with him, and I was invited later, this is considerably later, I was invited twice to lunch at the American Embassy. When there were visits from American congressmen and also British parliamentary delegation. A British parliamentary delegation came in 1947, and then I went with them to General MacArthur. But of course one heard a great deal about General MacArthur as well as seeing him, and he was a great man, and no doubt about it, he was a very great man. First of all, I think he was a brilliant soldier, but his administration of Japan must go down in history as one of the greatest military occupations that's ever happened. Certainly one of the most magnanimous, but also one of the most far-sighted. And there are, even today, there are Japanese intelligent or outstanding Japanese who regard General MacArthur as one of the architects of Japanese subsequent success.
In what way far-sighted?
Well, first of all, he brought about the land reform. And the land reform in Japan, which was an early movement, and it was organized and taken on by the government department of SCAP. There were many departments, but it was under General MacArthur's aegis. And that undoubtedly saved Japan from terrible civil conflict, probably communism. At one stroke, it deprived the Japan Communist Party and their supporters of any hope of gaining public support.
Did his land reform meet with support from all quarters, or was there any opposition that you came across?
Well, the opposition was naturally from the people who lost their land, but it was they were compensated, the landowners were compensated at a derisory sum. The post-war, the pre-war value of the land was given. Well, since the yen had depreciated by a factor of about 300 and something, it almost meant sequestration, but not exactly. And those people all eventually recovered, and I would say that there are very, very few voices. There were few voices raised at the time against it, and since then, none.
Was there any opposition from within the various Western missions there?
Not in respect of the land reform. The opposition to MacArthur's reforms came from people who thought he was treating the Japanese too softly, too easily. And I would suppose that that was primarily from Australia, perhaps something from the United Kingdom. The Chinese didn't count, you see, yet. They were weak, and Chiang Kai-shek really was not any longer an effective influence. So I would say that was where there was discontent, undoubtedly a worry in Australia that MacArthur was not being tough enough to the Japanese. But as he said, unless we can raise the Japanese up, they're going to be a burden around the neck of the American taxpayer forever. That was the driving force to get them off the back of the Japanese, of the American taxpayer.
Whilst you were there at that time, did you pay any visits to Hiroshima or Nagasaki?
Yes, I went to Hiroshima. I went to Hiroshima on October the 10th, I think.
What did you see there?
You see, the impact of Hiroshima on me at that time was not as great as subsequently, because all Japan was destroyed. Every town in Japan was destroyed, except Kyoto and Nara. And they had been destroyed by saturation bombing, incendiaries. And so from the outside, Hiroshima didn't look so very different from all the other towns. 80 towns were deliberately destroyed. The difference was, and of course the loss of life in the March 1945 bombing of Tokyo was greater than Hiroshima. That was terrible. But the one difference was that most of the towns that were destroyed later, quite methodically, in those towns, the population were given a chance to escape, because leaflets were dropped the day before or 2 days before saying your town is going to be destroyed next Tuesday, so take to the hills. And so the loss of life was much less. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were unforgivable. And it was only afterwards. I mean, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki made a great impact on me afterwards, and one which has lasted with me all my life since.
So you say it was unforgivable because of the lack of warning rather than the fact that it was a nuclear attack?
Well, it was unnecessary. I'm speaking now on my own personal view. You may ask why it was unnecessary. Afterwards, one of my jobs was to interrogate the general staff about all sorts of things. All Japan was destroyed, and it was apparent when I got in there that they could not have continued the war. So the idea that the two nuclear bombs saved thousands of lives by making it unnecessary to continue the war, I dismiss. Japan couldn't have gone on fighting. I mean, they could have thrown a few aircraft at us, but they had no petrol. They had no oil. You can't run any war without lubricating oil. They had no lubricating oil. Nothing worked. There were no cars. The railways were in a broken down state. It really was at the end. The general staff, when I interrogated them, officers of the General Staff, their view was that the real reason why the military, the senior military people, finally agreed to accept unconditional surrender was because the Russians declared war on the 8th of August. When every city has been destroyed by bombing, two more doesn't make all that difference. But when the Russians attacked, declared war on the 8th of August, then they saw, even the military, the senior army officers saw that this would be final disaster. Because if the Russians occupied Japan, there would be no survival of the Japanese polity.
So was that fear of communism?
Fear of Russia. Russian communism, yes. Fear of Russia. I don't know whether they made a distinction. Fear of Russia and Russian communist Russia.
Because presumably the Russians might well have got a zone of occupation.
Well,
of Japan.
They tried very hard. Only MacArthur resisted. MacArthur absolutely resisted that. But had they been able to drive further, supposing the Japanese had not surrendered, but had gone on, held out for another week, 10 days, then there would have been no holding the Russians. They'd have been in. And once in, there would be no way of getting them out. Haven't got them out of those four islands yet. Although, that's another issue. Anyway, that was the view of the senior officers of the General Staff that I interrogated. They may be wrong, but that was the view. And I think myself the dropping of those two bombs was a great disaster. Because you see, it's not only that the people, the thousands who were instantaneously killed, it's the hundreds and thousands who went on dying afterwards. And it will sour relations eventually, the knowledge of that.